Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Today is the third of a summer-long series of podcasts about the systems of camps and ghettos that pervaded Nazi Germany, its satellite states, and the regions it controlled. Earlier this summer, I talked with Jeff McGargy about the Holocaust Museum's Encyclopedia of Camps and Ghettos, and Sarah Helm about the women's camp of Ravensbrück. Later in the summer, I'll be speaking with Shelley Klein about the guards who staffed the camps, and with Dan Stone about the end and aftermath of the camp system. Today, though, in the third of the series, I'm thrilled to welcome Nick Vaxman to the show. Nick teaches at University College London and completed earlier a book about on German prisons in Nazi Germany. Recently, though, he's turned his attention to concentration camps. And after a couple books published in the early part of this decade that pushed research on the camps further, he's now written a comprehensive survey of the camps, titled, KL or KL, I'm not sure which, A History of the Nazi Concentration Camps. It comes in at something around 800 pages, and according to Amazon, something like 2.8 pounds. I use the word comprehensive advisedly, and we'll talk in the interview about what it means to research such a broad and difficult subject. But the book itself is tremendous, a well-conceived mixture of institutional history, narrative storytelling, and careful analysis. I expect it will become the standard history of the camps. It's not always easy to read, and I say that not meaning that it's badly written. It's wonderfully written. But it has the kind of narrative history he writes in a way that makes you feel some of the experiences. I read it on the Kindle as I led students across Europe. And I will say, I occasionally found myself having to put my Kindle down and spend some time staring out the window before I went back to it. But it's a wonderful treatment of the subject, and I'm greatly looking forward to talking with him about it. So, with that, Nick, welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for the very kind introduction, Kelly.
So, we always start with the same kind of way. Asking you to say a little bit about how you came to be interested in the subject of Nazi Germany and the Holocaust.
Well, I did my doctoral research, as you said earlier, on law and terror in Nazi Germany, resulting in a book called Hitler's Prisons. And the idea, what I was really interested in initially as a PhD student, was this question of how a regular legal system operates in a dictatorship like the Third Reich, what the connections, the potential frictions are with the political ideology and so on of the regime. So that's really what I was interested in. And that by definition meant that I also started to look at the relationship between regular prisons and the regular law and the system of lawlessness in the concentration camps. And, so I read a lot around that topic. And the more I read, the more I realized or was struck that though there are a huge number of important books on specific aspects of the camps, there wasn't any comprehensive history telling the story of the development of the camp system, the experiences of the inmates, the actions and backgrounds of the perpetrators in one volume. And the more I thought about that, the more I thought that that would be a valuable thing to try and write. And hey, 10 years later, here the book is.
It's a nice warning to present PhD students.
Yes.
So I have to ask, 10 years later, that seems like a very long time. And yet you point out in the introduction that it's not nearly enough time to read everything that's been written. How do you decide what to look at?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, the literature on the concentration camps, there's a vast number of memoirs. In actual fact, there's a much larger number of memoirs by survivors written in the immediate post-war period. It was very important for me in the book to try and get as many voices of these into the book, and maybe we can talk about that later. So there's a very large body of memoirs. There's also a huge body of scholarly literature on the camps, which emerged especially since the late 80s and then the 90s and since. And on top of that, of course, you have tens of thousands of documents, some of which have only been released fairly recently. So I had to make decisions all the way through about prioritizing kind of about which documents, which memoirs to pick. And that was actually one of the most difficult decisions on some level I had to make, because including one story or one individual prisoner meant kind of I had to kind of leave somebody else's experiences out. And though we might think of prisoners as some kind of uniform, anonymous mass, actually the more you think about the camps, the more you realize that each prisoner has their own story and their own history, which is shaped by their background, their ethnicity, their jobs, their nationality, their age, their gender, and so on. And it was very difficult to leave some of these stories out. But that said, as you said at the beginning, I mean, the book is 800 odd pages long, and I had to make some hard choices then.
So you could have, I imagine, simply chosen to make this an institutional history without including the kind of stories that you do from a prisoner's perspective. Why did you decide to include the prisoner perspective? Or maybe I should, why spend so much time taking care to include the prisoner's voices?
Well, because I think they offer us a perspective on the camps which no kind of general writing can give us. I mean, when I think about myself and what got me into history, you know, as a kid in the first place, then it was stories, it was individuals, and the structures of the camp system they don't just emerge, they don't just happen. They are made and built by individuals. So it's not just a question of looking at the victims and the prisoners. It's also a question for me in the book to look at the perpetrators and not, again, have them as some anonymous mass or as they appear in a lot of survivor memoirs, effectively unhinged sadists. There were some people who we would describe as such, but many more men and women who staffed the camp system had different motives for doing what they did. And I think we can't understand the development of the camp system if you only look very generally at the structures. So one of the decisions I made very early on in this book is that this wasn't, it's also an organizational history. It also tries to analyze and explain why the system moves in the very strange way it seems to do. I mean, there is no inherent logic to this. There is no master plan. And I try to explain why the trajectory is as it is. But I decided very early on that it was going to be absolutely essential to tell this also through the eyes of those who experienced, who suffered the camps, and those who made the camps.
The book actually reminds me a little bit of Shaul Friedlander's two-volume History of the Holocaust. Was that a model for you, or?
Well, that's a kind of, I mean, you know, that's a model I might aspire to. Kind of, it's a model I will never reach. But certainly, kind of, I think Friedlander's integrated history of the Holocaust was hugely important for me. I mean, there are a number of books which shaped me or influenced me, and that is certainly one of the key ones in the way in which he combined already in the first volume, which I read, I think, pretty much at the start of my PhD in the 90s, the way he combined the perspectives of the victims of German Jews in the first volume, using their testimonies from the time as contemporary as possible, written at a time without high insight, without clarity about where this history would go, also bringing in the voices of the perpetrators and then also the onlookers, the German public who was involved in one way or another in this story as well. So trying to weave this together as a comprehensive, what Friedlander calls integrated history, was certainly a model for what I tried to do here.
So let's turn to the book. And I guess my first question about this is, were the concentration camps part of the Nazis' long-term vision for what they would do when they took power?
That's a good question. I mean, the Nazis sometimes talked about concentration camps before coming to power. So it's not as if, you know, the idea of camps for locking away opponents or nuisances or what the Nazis might call community aliens was completely novel to them. That said, as I said before, there is no master plan. It's not as if Hitler is appointed as chancellor, and then he kind of, you know, opens the desk drawer and takes out the manual for concentration camps. What's so striking in many ways about the emergence of the camp system in 1933 is just how chaotic and unorganized and improvised it is. I mean, we now think of, I mean, take a place like Dachau. We now think of Dachau as the birthplace of this camp system. It's the only SS camp that lasts all the way through from the beginning to the end. It's the place where a lot of the SS camp SS leaders get their education, if you will, in violence and terror. It is the place where the rules and regulations of the camps are introduced, which then spread to other camps. So Dachau has a hugely important role in this story. But it doesn't start out in this way. It starts out as a improvised camp set up in March 33 in a ramshackle, broken down former munitions factory outside Munich, where the SS takes 100, 120 or so local communists. And kind of the guards are actually not SS men, but policemen, and they treat the prisoners reasonably well early on. And none of the prisoners and none of the guards could have imagined that this would somehow be the beginning of a 12-year or longer huge camp system, which then eventually spreads all across Europe. So there is enormous amount of improvisation early on. And as soon as camps are set up in Germany, and there are hundreds and hundreds of these improvised early camps set up to crush the political opposition, as soon as they're set up, they're closed down again, more or less all of them. Very few of them last for longer than a few weeks or months. So kind of, and then we come to this really incredible moment in 1934-35, where the Nazi regime effectively has to decide what kind of dictatorship it's going to be. Is it going to be a authoritarian dictatorship, but one that is based on some kind of Nazified law, in which case they don't need extra legal lawless terror in concentration camps. And there are a number of Nazi leaders, I mean, Frick, the interior minister, Göring as well, who argue for this kind of approach. And then there are others, led, of course, by Himmler, the chief of the SS, which has by then taken over the fledgling camp system, who argue that, well, actually, kind of lawless terror is absolutely vital, and the Nazi war against its enemies has only just started, and it's going to last for decades or centuries. And it is this kind of line which is ultimately successful. And Himmler persuades Hitler probably that you know, the camps need to stay. And this is then really the beginning of this more organized, systematic system. But even looking at the early years, in other words, you can see that there are twists and turns, and there is no clear master plan which the regime followed.
Is there so if there's no master plan, what kind of influences in these are maybe I should actually let me ask it this way. Where do the people who are kind of originally creating these first, and I historians often use the word wild camps, and I know you're not fond of that, or you think that needs to be moderated or carefully considered, but what are the influences they're looking at when they think about how to run these?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, I try to uncover that in the book. I mean, some historians of the concentration camps more broadly, more globally, look for links and connections between different types of camp systems in different countries. And you know, the gulag, if you will, was invented before the Nazi concentration camps were invented. But I'm not persuaded that the Nazis are really looking very hard outside Germany. The influences which the paramilitaries, who are behind most of these early camps in 1933, the influences they draw on are more the paramilitary experiences of violent street battles and warfare in the late period of the Weimar Republic, the failing first German democracy. They also look at experiences which some of them have made in the German military serving in the First World War, for example, seeing sometimes being imprisoned, sometimes in POW camps. I mean, a number of early concentration camp commandants had actually been prisoners in POW camps in the First World War, and other Nazi activists, given that the Nazis were so often engaged in illegal, brutal, violent behavior in the Weimar years, had seen the prison system, the Weimar prison system, from inside. Yeah. I mean, starting with Hitler, but also, I mean, somebody like Rudolf Höss, the later first commandant of Auschwitz, I mean, Höss spent several years in the Weimar period in a penitentiary. So these are men who have learned a lot about disciplinary institutions, about carceral institutions, and about how to terrorize and de-individualize inmates. And I think they draw on a range of these experiences early on.
You described the Night of the Long Knives as a turning point for the camp systems. How is that, or why is that?
Well, what you have to kind of imagine is that, as I say, early on, kind of it's paramilitaries mainly who found or set up most of these camps. Though the state through the police also gets involved from early on. And early on, the SA is the main Nazi paramilitary organization, the SA, and that is, which is led by Ernst Röhm. The SS under Himmler is much smaller. They set up fewer camps, and they are subordinate, officially at least, to the SA still. So the reason why the so-called Night of Long Knives in summer 1934 is so significant, when Hitler orders that Röhm and the SS is the SA is taken out, is that the main agency who's behind this, or enacting this, if you will, is the SS, and that leads to the SS kind of becoming predominant in the sphere of lawless terror and consolidating its takeover of the concentration camps. I mean, one of the big remaining SA camps was the one in Oranienburg, which is next to the German capital, Berlin, and as such has particular prominence. And Oranienburg is then taken over in a very symbolic way just days after Röhm is shot by the man who had shot Röhm, and that is Theodor Eicke, the head of the SS camp system and commandant of Dachau.
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, that there's a couple people whose names kind of emerge as really key players after this, and one is Himmler and the other is Eicke. Could you say a little bit about each and their vision for the camps and what role they play?
Sure. I mean, kind of Himmler is the kind of the godfather of the camps, if you will, and Eicke is his enforcer. So Himmler is the head of the SS. The SS emerges, as I've tried to describe, as the main agency running the concentration camp system, this lawless system of terror with its own rules, its own organization, its own guards, its own staff, even its own acronym. I mean, the word, kind of the abbreviation KL for Konzentrationslager, which I use as the title of the book. I mean, that is for Himmler, Konzentrationslager, KL, is almost like a copyright term. I mean, when other Nazi bigwigs start setting up their own kind of camps after the invasion of Poland, for example, Himmler goes around and actually says, you know, look, I'm, you know, my camps are concentration camps. You can't call any other camps concentration camps. So Himmler is in charge of this system overall, and sometimes gets involved, as is his wont, in minutiae to a mind-boggling extent. But he's also in charge of the general line, I think, the camp system, the broad trajectory or route the camp system takes. And his vision of the camps is one of lawless terror, an instrument of the regime to eliminate all those seen as standing in the way of the Nazis creating this mythical national community. And his targets, the vision of his aim of who needs to be removed from the national community changes over time. So early on, he trains his sights mainly on political opponents, above all on communists. Later in the 30s, he shifts it more to social outsiders. This is small-time criminals, so-called asocials, the homeless, beggars, prostitutes, homosexuals, and so on. And then in the war, it focuses increasingly on foreigners and then above all on Jews. So this is kind of Himmler. He's in overall charge, as I say, like the godfather of the system, the mastermind. But he needs somebody to implement his vision and to make it come true. And that man is Theodor Eicke, who's a kind of long-term devoted Nazi fighter, bruiser, a very charismatic man amongst his Nazi comrades, and also a man who's fallen foul of the regime early on. So Himmler gives him a second chance to redeem himself. I mean, actually, kind of effectively the call by Himmler to make Eicke commandant of Dachau reaches Eicke in a mental institution where he's held after a dispute with a local Gauleiter, a regional Gauleiter, so kind of a Nazi bigwig. So Eicke kind of owes everything to Himmler, and he repays him with absolute devotion. And in the same way, he inspires absolute devotion from a hardcore of SS men, which he gathers around himself. So Eicke starts implementing this vision of the camp in Dachau from summer 33, introduces new rules, new regulations, and also introduces this camp kind of SS, this corpse of committed, loyal, dedicated SS men who seek a career in the concentration camps. I mean, you know, at the beginning of the Nazi regime, being posted to the camps, even as a commandant, wasn't a career. It was something kind of, you know, you did for a couple of weeks and then you moved on. But the men around Eicke see this as a profession, effectively. And that it just happens that their profession is violence, terror, and murder. So Eicke really sets the basis, the groundwork of the camp system in Dachau, and then later as Himmler's first inspector of the concentration camps, a new title which comes with a new office in Berlin, and he's then in charge of effectively implementing this a general vision of the camps elsewhere where the Nazis set up concentration camps.
Yeah, you actually, if I'm reading you right, you kind of suggest, or you do suggest that by maybe 35, early 36, there's really a kind of a standardized model that emerged for the camps. Can you describe that?
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, this is the kind of, I mean, what happens kind of in 34, 35 is that the SS camp system is being made permanent. So I said before, there is this kind of tug of war kind of at the heart of the regime about what kind of dictatorship it should become. And it then becomes clear eventually that the SS camp system will become permanent. It gets permanent funding from the state. The SS, the camp SS kind of is established and so on. So this is the moment where the SS and Eicke and Himmler then start to build new camps. Remember the early camps like Dachau were found. Dachau was this dilapidated factory. The hundreds of other camps early on in 33 are set up all over the place in sports grounds, pubs, bars, old hotels, even a ship. What happens in the second of the 30s, now that this camp system is going to be permanent, is that the SS develops a vision of what a kind of ideal concentration camp will look like, and they start for the first time then to build from scratch new concentration camps. These are places like Sachsenhausen in 1936, near Berlin, which becomes a kind of new model camp. Other new camps include Ravensbrück in 1939, the first women's camp, Mauthausen, Flossenbürg, Buchenwald. So there are a number of these purpose-built camps. Dachau, the first camp from 33, is also completely rebuilt. So we've got, by 1939, by the time war breaks out, we have six camps in Germany and Austria. And these are all purpose-built new camps with prefabricated barracks, a roll call square, barbed wire surrounding the prisoner compound, an SS compound outside the prisoner compound. Then, you know, different industries where prisoners work in the running of the camp. So you might have bakeries or tailors' workshops and so on. So what we have emerging is almost little towns or cities where the prisoner compound is only one part of it. I mean, you also have SS living quarters. Officers move to these new housing settlements with their families, with their children, which might go to SS kindergartens and so on. So this becomes a kind of a city or town rather than just some kind of found place in the middle of wherever the Nazis could find it.
So who are the guards? Where do the guards come from and how are they trained?
Well, that's another good question. I said at the beginning that there isn't a typical prisoner experience. There isn't a typical guard in that sense either. There's no typical camp either. All of this changes significantly over time. Very early on in 1933, as I said, the men who staff these camps are not career SS men who see some kind of future for themselves in the camp system. I mean, quite often they are just commanded to certain camps. Quite often they, you know, these are the local SA or SS troops. Later on, one of the things Eike as head of this camp SS system wants to recruit a devoted community body of SS men running this camp system and staffing this camp system. And he wants volunteers. These are men who really want to serve the SS in the camps and fight, as Eike sees it, the internal enemy behind barbed wire. So there's a lot of martial rhetoric and the SS effectively, or the camp SS, presenting himself as the only troop before the war which is already engaged in warfare. So that it tries to appeal to a lot of the men who want to fight, who maybe missed out on fighting the First World War and now want to kind of have some kind of battle against these supposed enemies. Of course, this is no battle. I mean, they just beating, abusing, terrorizing, and killing individual prisoners. So Eike wants volunteers, and he wants young men. So these are kind of increasingly men in their very early 20s or more often than not in their late teens who join the SS as new recruits because Eike believed that they could be most easily molded. So what emerges then kind of out of these recruits is a fairly small a community of like-minded, dedicated, brutal tormentors, which then over the coming years start filling a lot of the key positions in the camps. So this is kind of, so when we talk kind of, you know, by the time war breaks out, we have a committed core of hardcore of camp SS men, and then a broader body of guards and so on around them, some of them more committed, some of them less committed, but all of them SS volunteers. If you look at the end of the war, the picture has changed completely. So yeah. Now you have a huge number of middle-aged German army reservists who are drafted in effectively to the camps. So kind of, I think by 45, half or more of the SS staff in the camps are actually army reservists, quite often elderly army reservists. So these are not people who have volunteered for the concentration camps in that sense, nor are they the young, bright-eyed volunteers that Eike had in mind in the 30s.
So in the pre-war years, how violent were these camps actually? Because you give a number of statistics about the number of people who are killed or die in the camps, and it's quite startling in terms of the number of people who die, and yet looking backwards from 45, it's actually startling in terms of how few people were killed in the pre-war years.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point to bear in mind. I mean, You're absolutely right that, and I think I make that point early on in the book, actually, at the start of the book, that we tend to kind of read the history of the camps backwards from the terrifying, horrifying images which the liberators took in 1945, with, you know, mountains of corpses of starved, dead, dying prisoners all over the camps in ditches and so on. And the we tend to associate these images with the concentration camps as a whole. And what we need to understand is that these kind of images describe a certain period in the time of the camps, namely the final stages. If he'd gone to the camps in the mid-1930s or late-30s, they would have looked completely different. And one of the big differences is that though death by the late-1930s is not entirely unusual, it isn't the norm either. Prisoners in the pre-war camps are far, far more likely to survive and indeed to be released again than to be killed in the camps. Bear in mind that the function of the camps in the pre-war years is not mass extermination or systematic killing. The function of the camps is different. It is early on to crush the political opposition. It is later on to try and remove and destroy what the Nazis call social outsiders. Economic functions come into this as well. Deterrence comes into this. There's all sorts of functions, but mass extermination is not one of the functions before the war. And that is one of the big things that changes after 1939.
So let's pursue that a little bit, because as I mentioned, I take students to Europe, and I've learned over time that I will get more students to go with me to Europe if I take them to Auschwitz. And that's a whole other topic that we could spend a while on. But what you point out in the book is that what most people think they know about Auschwitz is not the whole story.
Yeah, I mean, I think I mean, Auschwitz is absolutely central to any history of the concentration camps. I mean, there is that, you know, that is beyond question. And Auschwitz does play a very important part in KL in my book. There's a number of chapters which deal exclusively more or less with Auschwitz. So there is no question about the absolute centrality of Auschwitz in this story, but kind of having talked about this for many years to students and other interested members of the public, it's become clear to me that there is a strange way in which most people think of Auschwitz and the camps and the Holocaust as more or less synonymous. So they think of this as more or less being the same thing. And I would say three things about that. The first thing is that there is more to the Holocaust than Auschwitz. Auschwitz is the single most deadly site of the Holocaust. There's no other site in Nazi-controlled Europe where more Jews are murdered in a single place than Auschwitz. That said, the significant majority of Jews are still murdered elsewhere, either in ghettos or in ditches and forests mown down by special SS and police commandos in Eastern Europe, or in specific specially dedicated death camps like Treblinka, which serve only one function, and that is to kill as many Jews as quickly as possible. Concentration camps always have multiple functions. Death camps like Treblinka and the Holocaust only have one function, and that is to kill as many Jews as quickly as they can. So there is more to the Holocaust than Auschwitz. There's also more to Auschwitz than the Holocaust. People tend to think of Auschwitz as a camp which was set up to exterminate the Jews of Europe, but that's not true. Auschwitz is set up in 1940 initially as a camp to destroy the Polish political opposition. It then morphs in the following year, in 1941, in autumn 41, into a site where the SS imagines they will take huge numbers of Soviet POWs following the invasion of the Soviet Union in summer 41. The massive expansion of the Auschwitz main camp in Birkenau, which is now associated with, for all of us, the site of the gas chambers and the crematoria, which the Nazis or the SS builds to murder the Jews of Europe in Auschwitz, this site of Birkenau is not set up in autumn 41 in order to kill or exterminate Jews. It is initially set up to house and work to death vast numbers of Soviet POWs in the Nazi attempt to make the occupied East German, to put German settlements up in the East. So there is more to Auschwitz than the Holocaust. And kind of even at the height of the Holocaust in Auschwitz, there are large numbers of prisoners from other backgrounds, Polish prisoners, Soviet prisoners, Western European prisoners, and so on. So there's more to Auschwitz than the Holocaust. And finally, there's more to the camp system than Auschwitz. Again, Auschwitz holds a central place, as I said, in any history of the camps. There is no camp that's more deadly. There is no camp that holds more prisoners. But even at the height of the destructive power of Auschwitz, it holds probably about a third of the prisoners in this whole camp system. So the majority of prisoners are held elsewhere, and Auschwitz is part of this much, much wider network of camps with, if we look at the whole period of the Third Reich, 27 or so main camps and 1,100 or more satellites. So Auschwitz is part of this huge network with prisoners being sent to Auschwitz or taken from Auschwitz back to other camps, with staff arriving from elsewhere in Auschwitz or being sent elsewhere. I mean, Rudolf Hess, who I mentioned before, the first commandant of Auschwitz, learns his trade in Dachau in 1934. He arrives in Dachau in late 34 and learns about prisoner torment and abuse there. He catches the eye of his superiors and moves up in the hierarchy. He then becomes a middle manager, if you will, in Sachsenhausen, where he learns early in the war about systematic mass shootings and killings. And then he graduates to mass murder in Auschwitz. So the Auschwitz is linked to the other camps. It is part of a network of lawless terror. And I think we need to place Auschwitz back into this much wider context if we really want to understand it properly.
Did the existence, or were the camps simply a location where the Holocaust and genocide happened? Or did the existence and role and function of the camps actually play a role in shaping the kind of decisions and actions that lead to the Holocaust?
Probably a bit of both. I mean, with Auschwitz, the first thing you have to say is that, as I said, it's not set up as a Holocaust camp. It gradually... over a period of several months in 1942, is turned into one of the death camps of the Holocaust. And Auschwitz is very unusual in that it is the only concentration camp, which is also a major death camp of the Holocaust. So it's a kind of hybrid concentration camp and death camp, and that makes it quite unusual. But that process isn't premeditated, and it takes several months, as I say, for that to emerge in 1942. And even then, initially, a death camp like Treblinka is far more destructive in 1942 than Auschwitz is. So in that sense, Auschwitz comes quite late, if you will, to the Holocaust. At the same time, some of the measures which had been pioneered in the camps have an influence well beyond the camps. I mean, the SS in Auschwitz starts in 1941 when Soviet POWs arrive, for example, to differentiate between prisoners who can be still used for work in some way and be worked to death and those who will be killed straight away. So the idea of selections, of lethal selections, comes in the camps quite early. Think about the yellow triangles identifying Jews all over Europe, or in many places of Europe, as the Nazis take over and implement their policy during the war. Well, these kind of markers are actually first introduced in concentration camps before the war. The use of Cyclon B gas in Auschwitz is pioneered in 1941. That's before the Holocaust hits the camp as well. So there are a number of developments in the concentration camps going back to the period before 1942, which have some influence on what happens afterwards.
One of the really startling things that comes across in your book is the numbers and the explosion of the camp population, the size of the camp population, and the explosion of the number of camps and especially sub-camps. So why do these camps get so numerous in the middle of the war?
Yes, I mean, it is mind-boggling. I mean, when the war breaks out, I said before, we have some 20-odd thousand prisoners in six camps. By early 1945, a few months before the war ends, we have well over 700,000 prisoners a day in hundreds and hundreds of camps and satellite camps. If we try to understand why this happens, I think there's probably two things I would focus on for now. One is that the regime, of course, uses the camps as it spreads its tentacles all over Europe to break and intimidate the political opposition to establish its rule kind of in a number of these different countries and areas the regime takes over. So by 43, 44, we have a camp system which literally stretches all the way from way in Eastern Europe, from the Baltic states, all the way to the west and the small British Channel island of Alderney. So part of this has something to do with the political domination and attempt and aim of the regime to establish its rule and crush any opposition. So a number of these tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of prisoners who enter this camp system, who are dragged to the camp system, are seen as political opponents in one way or another. The second point would be the role of the camps in the Holocaust, which I've described. As the camps become more dominant in the Holocaust over time, or take a leading role, more and more camps are then set up also just for Jewish prisoners, or are taken over by the SS as concentration camps, former forced labor camps and places like this. And one third point to add, maybe to my two points, is that that is absolutely essential as well, is the economy and forced labor. And we haven't really talked about this. Mm-hmm. Forced labor is crucial to the camps right from the beginning. But in the early years of the camps, labor is used above all else to break prisoners, to torment prisoners, to abuse prisoners, to humiliate prisoners. Quite often, labor is completely senseless. I mean, you know, moving kind of huge, heavy rocks from one end of the camp to another and then back. Later on, the SS realizes that the prisoners they have in the camps could be used as an economic resource in some way. And they start initially to try and basically sell the slave laborers in the camps to the regime as perfect workers for providing the raw materials for the cities Hitler is dreaming of building. So that new camps like Mauthausen, and Flossenbürg in the late 30s are set up near quarries where the prisoners are then forced into quarrying. What happens, but that's before this satellite camp system expands so dramatically. What happens in the war, in the middle of the war, really, is that the SS, or Himmler, feels himself increasingly forced, I think, in order to keep hold of this camp system and to say to other Nazi leaders, you know, where the SS is hugely influential and important in the war effort, to try and force the slave laborers into production that's important, or construction that's important for the war effort. So increasingly, from 42, 43 onwards, prisoners are used as slave laborers and often work to death as slave laborers for huge, gigantic war effort related, factories which are being built underground, construction which is set up to house arms factories or clearing rubble in German cities or so on. So kind of what that means in turn is that then these satellite camps are set up near factories, near construction sites, in German cities and so on, where the prisoners are then abused and exploited. That in turn means also that terror becomes even more visible than it's ever been before. I mean, one of the important perspectives of the book, I mean, so far we've mainly talked about the prisoners and the perpetrators.
Exactly, yeah.
But the third perspective, in a sense, which I try to again and again weave into the narrative, is that of the onlookers, and above all, what you might call ordinary Germans. And what happens as this satellite camp system spreads is that more and more Germans see prisoners on the streets, or might maybe even work next to them or command them on building sites, or they see cars full of corpses, vans full of corpses being driven back to camps. They smell the smoke from the crematoria. They hear stories about escaped prisoners, or might even take part in hunts for escaped prisoners. So what happens later on in the war is that this camp system, this network of camps, becomes more and more enmeshed with German society. And if you will, the climax of that is in the last few months of the war, where you then have the dissolution of the camp system and death marches winding their way all the way from abandoned camps to God knows where, quite often without any sense of clear purpose or direction. And they literally march through German villages, towns, I mean, through the middle of nowhere. I've got one scene in the book fairly late on where a German woman, a kind of middle-aged German woman who works on a farm in the middle of nowhere in Bavaria, one afternoon witnesses a track of a few hundred prisoners from Buchenwald kind of arrive in that tiny hamlet. They stay overnight. The SS guy leading this track commands some space for his men and orders some food to be cooked for the SS. They shoot some prisoners and then they move on. And these kind of scenes happen all over Germany. So one of them, the reason why I think that's an important story is not least because of one of the many myths about the camps after the war, in Germany at least, is that these camps were generally invisible and that ordinary Germans didn't really know what went on. And one of the things I tried to describe in the book is that right from the start, many Germans had a fairly good general idea what the camps were about.
Well, we're starting to run out of time. I have a couple broad kind of concluding questions. And one of them is this, there's this kind of phrase, and I think it's Primo Levi's, although when I Googled it to try and figure it out, I get a whole bunch of references to beer companies. But the 20th century is the century of the lager, of the camp. And I'm wondering if it's helpful to think about the 20th century that way, and thus to think about the Nazi camps as something maybe not distinctive, but something that stands in for a broader period of time.
Well, I mean, I think you could answer this in two different ways. I mean, I think the Holocaust and the concentration camps do hold a very central important place in a history of the 20th century. So I think there can't be any question about that. Whether that makes the camps into symbols for the 20th century, I think is something else altogether. And I think it's Mark Mazower who asked the question, you know, why is one symbol, one historical symbol, better than another for a certain period? So, I mean, there's a number of other more positive symbols one could think of for the 20th century than the camps. I'd be reluctant personally to go down that route. The broader question, I think, that also then opens up is the question we've briefly touched on before, and that is the question: to what extent the Nazi camps are related to other camps? I mean, comparative historians have done a little bit of work on, you know, what are the similarities, what are the differences. Perhaps more interesting, in a way, is the work of transnational historians who could start to ask, but again, not many people have done this, surprisingly, you know, what are the influences maybe on the Nazi camps, on other camp systems, and vice versa? I mean, in a sense, that was a central question, though one that wasn't pursued in the end in the infamous or famous Historikerstreit, the debate, the quarrel of historians in Germany in the 1980s, where the provocative right-wing German historian Ernst Nolte kind of claimed that the Gulag had in some way influenced, if you will, the Nazi camps. Yes. And I've tried to kind of also look at that, and I have to say I've found no evidence to back that up. But nonetheless, I think these questions of, you know, how the Nazi camps or the Nazi terror system might be related, say, to terror systems elsewhere in fascist states like Italy or Spain. We know that Himmler goes to have a look at Franco's camps in Spain. A Spanish police commission visits Sachsenhausen in 1940 in Germany. Equally, you know, there are connections between Italy and Nazi Germany as well. So these might be kind of areas where we can come to more fruitful themes than just this kind of bland and generalized talk of the century of camps.
So we're taping this in the middle of July, and probably it will post in late July or early August. And this is frequently a time when people are on vacation, have a little bit more time to read than otherwise. So I'm wondering if you could suggest one or two books that were meaningful to you, whether they're academic histories or whether they're memoirs or fiction or something else. What should our listeners read this weekend?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, kind of speaking for myself, kind of, you know, without moving the author too much into the middle of this story, I mean, you know, I spent 10 years researching and writing KL. And I have to say that as soon as I was done with my days reading and writing, I try to read things which are about as far removed from history and German history, and especially the history of the Nazi period as possible. So, you know, I might read some Evelyn Waugh or kind of something kind of very, very different to this. But, you know, kind of if I think about books which I think, you know, readers might want to look at and they might not have come across them already. I mean, one book which really was important to me is a memoir which was written not that long ago by Thomas Bergenthal, and it's called A Lucky Child. And Bergenthal's story is quite extraordinary. And actually, one of my chapters, I mean, all of the chapters in KL start with an individual story and history to try and outline some of the general themes which are going to be taken up in that chapter. And the last big chapter of the book starts with Thomas's story. And it is a story of a 10-year-old boy in 1945, early 45, who arrives, who survives the death march from Auschwitz as a 10-year-old and arrives in Sachsenhausen in early 1945, lies in the infirmary there. I think some of his toes are amputated. And the general likelihood that a boy like him would survive the last few months in a concentration camp were absolutely remote. And still he survives. And he survives not least, I think, because a much older Norwegian prisoner called Ott Nansen takes pity on him, visits him in the infirmary, brings him food. And that is one of the contributing factors, I think, to his ultimate survival. And Thomas Bergenthal tells this story kind of many decades after the war in a very moving and powerful way. And one could also read, as I did in the book, the diaries which this Norwegian prisoner who meets him at 45 writes at the time. I mean, that is one of the extraordinary sources for historians, are secret diaries by prisoners. And Nansen is one of the prisoners who keeps a diary which runs to several hundreds of pages. So Nansen actually describes the moment he encounters Tommy, as he calls him, kind of in Sachsenhausen, and he leaves him in spring 45, convinced that he will never see him again. And as Thomas Bergenthal then writes in his book, they do meet again after the war. He visits Ott Nansen in Norway and his family. And it's a very moving, powerful, sobering book. So that's what I would recommend to your readers and listeners.
Well, I've got something to do this weekend. What are you doing now? What's your next, or maybe I should ask, maybe you won't be doing this subject again, but what is your next project?
Well, I deliberately, after a very, very big project like this, wanted to kind of wait a little bit to decide kind of where it will take me next. So there's a number of projects which I'm thinking about. I'm still interested in perpetrators kind of the Holocaust, and I might do something there. But I think I've also got some ideas of moving beyond the Third Reich. So kind of, but I think I just wanted to really finish this book. It's taken me a long time, and just take a breather and decide where to go next.
As one of my previous interviewees said, the proper response to that question is, I'm going to go garden, or I'm going to go run, or something, anything else than look at materials again.
Well, that is absolutely right. I mean, kind of, yes, maybe I should get into gardening or something.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and I know that we've just touched the surface of it, and I hope that those who are listening to the program have a chance to read it and get a full appreciation for all the work you've done. But for now, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I hope that we'll have a chance to have you on again, but until then, I hope you have a great post-book relaxation time.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, I'll look into the gardening. Thank you.
All right, take care.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Nick Waxman about his new book, KL, A History of the Nazi Concentration Camps. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books and Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll come back next time, when I'll continue our summer-long series of interviews about the camps and ghettos in World War II by talking with Dan Stone about his wonderful new book about the end and memory of the concentration camp system. Until then, thanks for the download, and have a great month.